Frames of Reference.
Three films, two cinephiles, one podcast.
Cinema is my secret passion.
It's a foreign movie. A film is what it is.
But art films make people feel funny.
This film was a personal vision, not a marketing machine.
We're getting too many mainstream movies.
And we're back.
Yeah, it's been a little while on our end. It probably won't be on your end. We're both a little bit under the weather, but we are now recording in the new year. So today we're looking at the works of Alfonso Cuarón, who is a Mexican filmmaker who came really to the forefront of independent cinema in the late 90s, early 2000s. He's done some very, very large films. He's also done some very intimate small films. Most people will probably know him for films like Harry Potter and the Prisoner of Azkaban or Gravity. But he's also, even to this day, been able to do these really intimate portraits of Mexican culture.
Yeah, his ability to show the world and the characters and treat the world and the setting almost as its own character, like, comes through in all three of these movies so strongly.
And not only that, but, like, there's some directors who do big studio pictures and then do little intimate pictures, and you'll be like, oh, that was a one-for-them, one-for-me thing. And, you know, you don't see the same craft. But you can apply that to Great Expectations, to A Little Princess, to Harry Potter, to Gravity, of just the way he makes the world around the characters live and breathe and be a moving part with many facets that are all going at the same time. And every other character in his films is on their own trajectory with their own goals and their own, you know, agenda. It's something you can see across a lot of things. I think A Little Princess is actually a really good film to use for talking about, like, how to watch films critically with kids.
Mm-hmm.
And I don't know, I was pretty critical of Gravity when it came out. As you know, I thought it was a little style over substance, but I rewatched it a few weeks ago, and it is incredible how, for a film that essentially just has three characters, the two leads, and the vastness of space as a third, he manages to have that space itself be such a rich experience, in a film starring, you know, George Clooney and Sandra Bullock, and that made almost $1 billion, you know?
Yeah. And, like, I think this is a relevant thing to bring up in the age of, like, streaming and the age of, like, distracted watching. But these are movies that you, like, you gotta watch with your eyes, and you will be rewarded by doing that.
Which is interesting, because he was one of the first serious directors to go and make a movie with Netflix.
Mm, yeah.
And, like, I am lucky enough to have been one of the few people to have gotten to see Roma projected in a theater. But for most people, that just dropped on Netflix.
That's true. And I hadn't thought of that.
You can make the economic argument that who's going to spend $15 million on this little intimate film from Alfonso Cuarón. But, you know, it's clear he had a lot of freedom in Netflix, and I think he values that over the studio blitz.
Mm-hmm.
But this was also, you know, 6 years ago, so maybe things have changed.
That is true. I can't believe that was actually 6 years ago, because I do remember when that came out.
You have the idea of art filmmakers, like, not taking streaming seriously. It's kind of contrasted by, like, Richard Linklater. He put out a movie last year that was an animated movie about the Apollo missions and space in his childhood. I don't know anyone outside of the film critic circles who actually watched it. It's fantastic. It got lost. A new Richard Linklater movie just got utterly missed. You know, compare that to, like, the zeitgeist around Boyhood.
Mm, yeah. And also, like, I feel like people don't take animation as seriously of a medium.
Well, there was a whole interesting debate with that film over, because it was rotoscoped.
Oh.
Which, for those who don't know, rotoscoping is the process of filming something with a camera and then animating over it very, very meticulously. A great example of this in a documentary is the film Tower. It came out in 2016.
And a horrifying example is Bakshi's Lord of the Rings, which if you've seen it,
yes,
you've got a special rotoscope taste in your mouth.
That's
sorry.
A deep cut.
Sorry. It lives in my head rent-free 24/7. I will never recover from that movie.
I consider Tower one of the greatest documentaries I've ever seen, and my pride in having beaten it for best film at a film festival is just humble brag.
I love that. Okay. But yeah, I guess so I didn't realize there was like a controversy around like the fact that it was a rotoscoped, like how to.
So the controversy was whether it's actually an animated film for the it was for when it was being nominated for awards. The Academy ruled that it was not an animated film.
Interesting.
I do not agree with that ruling, but sure.
That is, I'm gonna have to watch it. I have not seen it. I'll confess.
It's really good.
That sounds like exactly up my alley, though. So yeah. I will definitely
like,
be checking that
out. If you like Linklater, that is a great deep cut from last year that a lot of people missed.
Yeah. All right. Not us talking about a different director in a different movie.
At some point, we will go through Linklater's Before trilogy.
It'll happen.
But so what was your first Alfonso Cuarón movie?
So I think like many people in my age group, my first Cuarón movie was Prisoner of Azkaban.
Yes.
Mine
was A Little Princess, which that's okay. Probably, which I remember the VHS very vividly being at the library and getting that. And like, man, Warner Brothers was on a real kick in the mid 90s of giving art directors these classic children's novels to adapt, because you also had the Secret Garden that in that same time. That's an utter masterpiece.
I think that's such the move, though, like giving those classic children's stories to artistic directors.
They're gorgeous, intimate works. I can rewatch those movies endlessly. But yeah, no, my second one was definitely Prisoner of Azkaban.
Presumably you saw that in theaters, right?
No, I didn't. I was not allowed to read Harry Potter at the time.
Oh, I forgot.
I watched that movie on a pirated screener.
Nice. I watched it on a DVD from Target when I was like 17 or 16, I guess.
I have a lot of thoughts on that as an adaptation. I think it's kind of where that film franchise went wrong as an adaptation. But as a work of cinema, it is just absolutely exceptional, and you don't often see franchise films with that level of care. It is a beautiful movie. It's got some really spectacular visual language. It's kind of frustrating when you hear people shortchange the adaptation and be like, oh, well, he spent so much time showing birds flying around. He could have covered more of the actual book story. But like, those shots matter. That's making the world come alive. You feel like you get a great sense of scope of the environment of that movie. And that's another really great introduction to his filmmaking. I feel like that is as good of an introduction to his filmmaking as almost any of his other films, and it's so accessible for families and kids, barring Daniel Radcliffe's atrocious crying.
R.I.P. We can't all be good criers on the first go.
He was 13.
He was 13. He did his best. He was that friend.
But you know, my first Cuarón movie in theaters was Children of Men.
Oh, okay.
Which, going back to the dawn of podcasting, The Totally Rad Show, which was a Revision 3 product in 2006, hosted by Alex Albrecht from Dignation and Jeff Cannata, and Dan Trachtenberg, who went on to be a fairly notable director, doing The Boys and doing 10 Cloverfield Lane and doing Prey, you know, doing a lot of really exciting action movies the last few years. They included it in their best of the year list at the end of the year. And I, living in a small town in the Poconos, saw that it was playing. It was the one film playing at my local art house, which I could walk to.
You're like, perfect. The stars have aligned.
So I was literally like, they said it's a post-apocalyptic dystopian tale. That sounds great.
What more could a 13-year-old want to watch?
So I, you know, got over there and bought a ticket. And thankfully, that theater never checked ages. And yeah, it spoke to my political ideas at the time very deeply. But wow, that was a fantastic experience. And it stuck with me. It's kind of weird. I hadn't seen it since its initial HD DVD release the following year. but it always left like a massive effect on me. It always kind of was how I envisioned a grand dystopian film. You know, when we talk about things like the video game series Fallout getting a screen adaptation, those kinds of ideas, it's always kind of how I visualize it. And it was really great to kind of return to that.
Yeah, I think you could definitely like, I'm thinking of other like YA dystopias that were really popular when I was coming of age, and the weight of Children of Men compared with those movies.
The stakes are continuously high.
So, yeah.
I mean, going back to Harry Potter, if Karan had stayed on for the rest of that series, the way he, in Children of Men, weaves realism in his ability to portray fascism and how direct it is, imagine what the later Harry Potter films would have been like through that lens.
Oh my gosh.
Everything has stakes, the intensity of those movies. And that carries through to Gravity, I really think. Gravity, you are on the edge of your seat with stress. You don't know what's going to happen. It feels like at any time anything could happen and our hero character could be lost. Mm-hmm. Space feels like so threatening. Everything has stakes. Everything matters.
The parallel world where he finished the rest of the Harry Potter films lives in the parallel world where Guillermo del Toro got to direct The Hobbit.
Oh, yeah. And like, I'm not sure if they would have been good, but they sure would have been interesting.
They would have been something. I would have watched them.
But we wouldn't have gotten Children of Men. Or Gravity, probably.
That's a fair point. That's pretty extended commitment, doing those movies.
That's David Yates' life now.
Shout out. Bless.
Ooh.
I feel like, could talk about Harry Potter adaptations, like, all day. Because
yes,
we share a lot of opinions, but we also have very different opinions. Because you were well acquainted with the franchise, with the books, before you watched the movies. Whereas I, read the books and watched the movies within a month of each other, because I read the entire series in a month and then watched all the movies back to back.
I also, and we should preface with this, that we stand with our trans allies and J.K. Rowling's a TERF.
Absolutely.
But yeah, I also walked out of the sixth movie and said I would never watch the rest of the franchise.
Yeah.
While adoring the books.
Yeah.
So I didn't watch the last two movies of that series until the pandemic, like a decade later. So that's the thing. But yeah, no, it's interesting to kind of look at Prisoner of Azkaban as one of Karan's most, I think it's his most commercial movie. It's basically the same ballpark as Gravity as being his most commercial movie.
Mm.
It's definitely got a huge cultural impact. So much the visuals of that film shaped how people perceive that franchise, because it was such a dramatic departure from the previous films. I do think it's a very mixed bag of being intensely beautiful, but also a really flawed adaptation.
Yeah, the question of art versus adaptation, and then also the idea that, you know, this isn't a movie in a vacuum, it's part of a franchise with the same cast and the same, story following up, definitely, I think, made Goblet of Fire a rougher ride than it would have been in the hands of a different director.
Well, we can apply those same criticisms to Children of Men, which basically discards 90% of the book.
Mm-hmm.
The difference there is it is a standalone work. It doesn't have things that it needs to set up for future films. Karan famously said about Harry Potter that he didn't need to read the rest of the books to know what's important, because everything that's important should be in the screenplay. You know, how much does that falls on the screenwriter and how much that falls on him is a difficult question. But I definitely think there's things that franchise is setting up as far as the relationship with Sirius Black and the understanding of who the Marauders were that is just utterly unaddressed in that film. And there is no time going forward in that franchise where they could correct that in a elegant way. So you completely change the relationships of a bunch of those characters by not adhering to the arcs of the book. And I don't think it's a problem in Children of Men at all. Children of Men is a really good novel by P.D. James, but they basically only share a core concept.
Yeah.
Enough about that.
But now on to the actual three films for today.
Yes.
Which I think we've referenced all three in this little sidebar.
We actually haven't referenced Et tu, Mama, también.
Oh, did I not mention it? Oh, dang. All right. Well, that's what we're starting with. So
yeah.
Let's kick it off.
Which is his Et tu, Mama, también came out in 2001 on the festival circuit. It's his fourth film, coming after his debut, Solo con tu pareja, which was a Spanish language, very intimate movie about relationships, much like this one. But in between that, he made two films, one for Warner Brothers, one for 20th Century Fox. He did an adaptation of A Little Princess, which was a just delightful, wonderful adaptation. And he did an adaptation of Great Expectations, the Dickens novel, starring Ethan Hawke and Gwyneth Paltrow, which does not get remembered with as much attention as it should, honestly. I really like that movie.
I will have to watch it because that is not a cast combo that was on any bingo card in my mind.
It also has Hank Azaria.
I was like, okay. Yeah, no, I... Okay,
Walter Plain is Hank Azaria.
Oh my gosh. But
yeah, no.
Okay, I know what I'm doing this weekend.
I think I still have a copy of it. But yeah, it also has De Niro in it. Like, it's a crazy cast.
Okay, love that. Anyway.
So he achieved both, like, art circle notoriety at this point and also a fair amount of studio success. So he had the ability to get funding for Et tu Mama Tambien, which is a very brave, bold movie. It's got a fairly substantial budget for Mexican cinema at the time. It really took film culture by storm. It premiered at Venice, where it took the Screenplay Award, and then it won the Spirit Award for Best International Film and got an Oscar nomination for Best Screenplay. And it really was kind of this like film festival darling of 2001 with a lot of discussion when the DVD came out. It rented very well. It very quickly wound its way into the kind of cultural discussions that happen in film circles in film school. Today, it's available from Criterion in the U.S. on Blu-ray. There's also a U.K. Blu-ray, but it is dramatically inferior to the U.S. one. So if you have a region-free player, make sure you import that. It's also streaming on AMC+. There is some notable history here. In 2001, Mexico still had a formal film censorship board, much like Britain, much like Italy, a number of other countries, where for a film to be released, it has to be approved by the censorship board to show in theaters. And the film initially received an 18-plus adults-only rating from the board. There was a significant amount of discourse and complaints alleging that this was a politically motivated decision as a result of corruption because the film has some very political notes. And the public outcry over this resulted in the censorship board being dismantled and replaced with an independent agency similar to what we have in the US. And parents were allowed to choose whether their children would be admitted to a film that was considered, inappropriate. It also had censorship issues in the U.S. because while we do not have a formal censorship board, most of the major chains of movie theater and rental houses will not rent or show an NC-17 product. This was still very much the era of Blockbuster. So when the film received an NC-17, it was essentially not tenable financially in the U.S. Notably, famed critic Roger Ebert took this event to basically charge industry professionals with being more outraged over this blatant censorship with an essay titled "Why Do Serious Film People Not Rise Up in Rage and Tear Down the Rating System That Infantilizes Their Own Work?" We've had a lot of conversations over the last couple decades about not only the MPAA and how the film system works, but also how it treats independent cinema or foreign cinema differently than big studio pictures. Also, how things like homosexuality are treated differently than heterosexuality. Most famously, there's the documentary "This Film Was Not Yet Rated" that came out a couple years after this movie that really explores corruption on the censorship era. So this is just an interesting tidbit in the history of how movies are made accessible to people, how they're rated, how they're gatekept from young audiences.
Out of interest, if a film was released unrated in the U.S. around this time, was it guaranteed to have any kind of success? I mean, surely if someone saw something was unrated, they would question why it hadn't been rated.
So it's a common tactic to, if you get an NC-17, you surrender it so you don't have a rating.
Okay.
This has kind of fallen off in recent years, but so like Blockbuster would rent non-pornographic unrated movies. That mm-hmm. was a thing that they would offer. They would not rent an NC-17 title.
Oh.
So, yeah, that was a thing. Like, again, at this point, this is kind of Blockbuster controls a significant amount of the American rental market. But movie chains, like the big Megaplex movie theater chains, will not show an unrated product.
Okay, interesting.
And, like, they will sometimes show an NC-17 product. Showgirls, which... disclaimer, Vinegar Syndrome, my employer, is the current distributor of, is quite famous for like all these stories of like the movie theaters hiring police to check ID to get into the movie and things like that. But you don't see that kind of event happening often. You know, art house theaters will play anything.
Right. That is interesting. I haven't thought a lot about ratings for films because I'm not a huge movie theater goer.
Well, even getting an R is a financial death sentence to a movie, but getting an NC-17 is just horrific.
Mm.
And that's really difficult when we look at how works that portray female pleasure in a more positive light than the male perspective, works that portray homosexuality, etc., all consistently get harsher ratings than what would on a rubric be equal portrayal.
Mm-hmm.
One of the base examples is in the same year, and this is again pulled from This Film Is Not Yet Rated, which is a fantastic documentary, Boys Don't Cry. You have a character who was assigned female at birth masturbating. And it's all under the clothes. It's all in shadow. It's very discreet. And the censors had a problem with that. This is 1999. This is the same year as American Pie has a male character masturbating into an apple pie. And that gets, that is very explicit. And that gets an R. That's A-okay. But, this is kind of contextualizing 2001. We have a lot of conversations about film censorship going on. We have a lot of conversations about how indies are treated differently. You're starting to get some real muscle in independent cinema, a form of like the Weinstein brothers. So it's kind of a product of force arguing for change in how we have access to movies.
That is really interesting. I did not know any of that going into watching this film. So the film stars Mirabel Verdú as Luisa Cortes, Gael García Bernal as Julio, and Diego Luna as Tenoch.
This is a road movie in the style of like a Wim Wenders movie. They are traveling to a destination across a vast expanse of land, but it's not really about the destination.
It's about the destination in their hearts. No, it's about the journey they're taking as well over the course of this like physical road trip. They're all at a crossroads in their lives.
Yeah. Also, like, have you ever traveled with people you just met?
Tragically, no.
Oh, that's safe.
I keep it real safe.
have you never traveled cross-country in a car with somebody you barely know?
I try to avoid getting in the car with people I don't know.
Well, you have so many less stories.
I know.
But no, it's very spontaneous in that way that youth often is. It's also very, like, angsty and frustrated. It's got all those classic coming-of-age notes. Tenoch and Julio are lifelong close friends. And as they're entering adulthood, they're graduating from high school. You're starting to get some friction. A lot of it is over girls. There's a lot of discussion about who's fucking who. There's increased tension between them over, cheating with each other's girlfriends. And lying about how they spend their time. They're kind of at a bit of a rough spot in their friendship, and I don't think either of them truly realizes how rough that spot is. There's also a significant amount of like unresolved tension and chemistry that is often read as a queer attraction to each other, and I think that's a very interesting lens to look at this story through. It takes place in 1999, and there is a significant amount of political upheaval happening. You have a lot of anxiety and unknowing political future. You see kind of these warning signs of fascism taking over at many points throughout the film. You have also like a kind of apathy of these two young people about the corruption of politics that's happening around them. They kind of see horrors happening because of the circumstances, and they just kind of keep going because that's how things are. You also have one of the first things you know is that Tenoch is the son of a diplomat and is upper class, and Julio is working class with a single mother, and they are friends across that divide, but at times that divide is very palpable. You can clearly see it. There's a hierarchy, and it normally doesn't openly come into their friendship, but at times it's an undercurrent.
Yeah, it's really interesting to me with their friendship is during this road trip with Luisa, they emphasize to her how strong their friendship is, how they have a manifesto of like the rules that they do and don't follow and why that makes them strong.
And, this film exists in a post-Fight Club world. And it is so like angsty, hormonal teenager list of rules to a code to live your life. Like, this is not like some Franciscan Brothers code. This is like,
live fast, die young. And they explicitly emphasize, you know, with the dialogue and what is and what is not, you know, spoken about in this film is very important, because there's a narrator who cuts through the lens that these characters live through to really say the truth.
Yeah. Oh, they're not following this cut at all.
Yeah. So the way that they like emphasize to each other, like, we were best friends, like, we live by this code, and there's almost this element of like going through motions of friendship because that's what's familiar. When in reality, as the narrator emphasizes, there is definitely like tension between the two of them.
There's a lot of unresolved, it's often read as queer attraction to each other that they're in denial about. I think that is likely an intended subtext of this movie.
I would agree with that. I definitely, like, with what happens at the end, and I don't want to jump ahead here, it changes the entire, like, understanding of everything that's come before in the movie. But even partway through the movie, I was like,
Wow, what an interesting friendship.
I was like, wow, you're really jealous there, buddy. Sure, there for is the reasons you think it is.
There's a lot of projection going on in this friendship, you know?
You know. But, yeah, they're, at the beginning of this movie, they're very immature, both about like their relationship with each other, their relationship with their girlfriends who are studying abroad in Italy. There's this, they don't have a very, I would say, very mature grasp of like sex, even.
Yeah.
Or consequence. Yeah. They're just wild. Absolutely wild.
They're bragging about how good they are in bed, and it's like, no, you are, you know what, 17, 18 year old boys. Like,
you may think you're cool. No.
But you're not.
You're not. And you'll wake up in 7 years and realize that.
You are hiding in your girlfriend's parents' bedroom. Like, no. So, yeah, when we start, both of their girlfriends are leaving to study abroad for the summer. So they basically have a bunch of free time all of a sudden that is not spent, you know, in private spaces spending with their girlfriends.
Quality time with their girlfriends.
Also, yeah.
I'm just teasing. But they're at a loose end. They are essentially kind of are finding ways to burn through the summer because they have nothing better to do.
Julio is invited to join Tinoc at a family wedding, where they're reintroduced to Tinoc's cousin, who has his new wife, Luisa. We get an intense, immediate lack of chemistry between this married couple. But, like, the boys are immediately very, very attracted to her, and, like, openly invite her to join them at this awesome secret beach that only the locals like them know. They've never actually been to this beach, but they lie and say, oh yeah, we go there all the time, you should join us. And she politely declines. It's kind of awkward because they're kind of flirting with her while she's married and her husband's like 5 feet away. But
and she's like, not to complicate more dynamics here, but yeah, she's in like her late 20s, older. And they're like
probably 30s.
Yeah. And they're barely like crawling out of high school right now.
Yeah. Just a lot of confidence. The actress was at least in her mid 30s.
Mm-hmm.
And that is kind of who these characters are. They are shameless.
And incorrigible.
You know, again, when we look at this through a queer lens, you can be like, oh, this is projection. Mm. How often do we see the story of this, like, you know, hyper-masculinity from people who are trying to fit into a social circle, who are trying to fit into a society that would not tolerate anything less, but gives a free pass to boys will be boys.
Mm-hmm. And live in a society where they don't even have the tools and vocabulary to even, like, really understand themselves as well.
Very early on, in a conversation with Luisa, actually, they mentioned that one of their friends is gay.
Mm-hmm.
They use a slur to refer to it. And she's like, is that a problem? They go, and they say, no, they're fine to it. But they still are, like, he is an other for that reason.
Mm-hmm.
So that's just... this film is so queer. So they kind of depart. They understand that she's not actually going to call to go to the beach, and they just kind of go their separate ways. We then see that Luisa has seen a doctor. We don't quite know why, and then she gets a call from her drunk husband, who confesses to her that he has been cheating on her. So things quickly reach kind of a breaking point for her. And she leaves him. She calls Tanakh and tells him that she does want to come to the beach and kind of like throws her entire life into just leaving and getting away from the situation and running. So Tanakh and Julio were not actually planning to go to the beach. They don't know where the beach is. So they kind of scramble to be able to present to the facade. They get, you know, very vague and unclear directions from a friend. They get some supplies and they pick up Luisa and they're on their way.
So as they begin this journey, as we kind of referenced to before, they're making different discoveries about one another. And they also are, some tensions are starting to rise as more things are revealed about each of the characters. This is kind of where the boys are talking to Luisa about their friendship, how close they are, their manifesto, all that stuff. And Luisa, this is a really different experience for her because she has lived her whole life according to, like, doing her duty to other people. She cared for her ill mother and then immediately got married. And, like, she's always fulfilled, like, the duties that others have put upon her. And so this is like her first time freely doing something of her own accord for herself. She is having a really hard time about something. We don't really, you know, we think at the beginning it's about her husband, and she calls him to like tell him that she's leaving him forever. She hopes he can be happy and basically makes it very clear that she has no intention of returning to him. And she is frequently like at different stops on this journey is having like, is crying, having breakdowns in hotel rooms. It's not good. And the boys initially like try and spy on her at one of the first stops that they make. And I think this is worth like pointing out because they're very immature and they have a very immature view of her. They objectify
her continuously.
Yeah, she is like the object of all their like sexual desires. And I think it's a really important moment that the first time they try and spy on her in this movie, she's just crying. She's just crying at the end of her bed, clearly having kind of a mental breakdown. And it kind of gives them cause for like a pause. And they're like, oh, and I think it's, you know, a little bit.
Women are more than just something to be attracted to.
Women cry? What? No. There's this moment of like reality kind of reminding these boys like this is a person. And I do think that it's important to note that Luisa is aware that they're trying like spy on her, and she kind of immediately like dissuades
them. Playful. She knows exactly what's going on. She's very playful, asking them about their sex lives and everything. You know, she knows what they want.
Yeah, Luisa. And what I really like about her as a character in this film is she is very aware of everything. Yep. She is not taken by surprise by any of the absolute anything that goes down. She's not just going along because she doesn't know what's happening. She's deeply conscious and aware, in many ways more conscious and aware of her own existence in this world than the boys are. And that makes sense when you get to, you know, the end of the movie. Then we kind of get into, I think it's their second stop. Luisa and Tanakh end up having sex because he comes in to like get some shampoo from her. She ends up, would we say seduce him? I don't know.
She seduces him. He's also like emotionally compromised.
Yeah, like that's not what I would call a great thing at all by any means.
They are adults, but it feels really uncomfortable.
Yeah, it's super messy. I was like, damn, I don't even know what to do with that. But long story short, they have sex together. Julio finds out and is like super duper jealous out of nowhere. Who he's jealous at, I think even the narrator makes very like unclear. The narrator is like, feels like a jealousy, doesn't explicitly say he's like jealous that Tanakh got to sleep with Luisa. Mm-hmm. And that's my first of the movie. As the tensions rise, basically Julio tells Tanakh that he has actually slept with Tanuk's girlfriend. And without any kind of self-awareness for what he's just done.
Do we believe this?
I didn't. I thought he was just like saying it to like get him upset and to like get back at him. You know, things kind of spiral out of here. Like Tanakh gets super mad at Julio. And then later in the car, he tells Julio that he's actually slept with Julio's girlfriend. And so these two get the level of like angry and pissed at each other that only two like hormonal young guys who are like posturing hardcore could get. Yep. Like a special cocktail.
Just kiss already. Yeah.
Like they're just so mad. Again, in another scene where I'm like, I'm very uncomfortable with this. Luisa then like sleeps with Julio because in her eyes, I think she's trying to like follow their code and she's trying to like rectify the situation between the two of them. She's like, oh, I'll just make it equal. You know, you're these young people.
Brotherhood.
Brotherhood, whatever. But no, they're still big full of hurt feelings. Why? Question mark. We will learn later. But again, a very, for me, uncomfortable sex scene.
It's meant to be uncomfortable.
I spent the whole time being like, oh my gosh, the tensions are not healed. And Luisa even tries to just like walk. She gets so frustrated with them that she's just like, I'm just going to like screw you guys. She gets out of the car. She walks away. And that's kind of when the boys have a moment where they're like, okay, like, let's get to the beach. Get her back, you know, let's get this back on track in their minds. So during this drive, they find that overnight they have arrived at this absolutely gorgeous beach and they start to spend time there. Luisa goes like straight into the water. I think that's important to note. Like, she's very free and happy suddenly when she's at this beach. They meet a local fisherman named Chuy who takes them out with his family to like explore the coves. It turns out that the place they've been talking about is a real place with a name, Heaven's Mouth.
Yes.
Which is like a funny moment because as far as Luisa knows, but like I'm sure she knows that they were bullshitting her this whole time.
So I think she actually says that.
Yeah. But like there's a moment where he's like, oh yeah, this is Heaven's Mouth, where like Tanuk and Julio look at each other and they're like, oh, it's real. It's real.
I think it's interesting to talk about fiction of Choi because this is yet another dimension of class.
Mm-hmm.
Tanakh is upper class. Julio is middle class. And then we see the poverty that this family is living in, but they are happy.
Yeah.
And their livelihood is being threatened by, you know, industrialization and attempts to change their culture.
Yeah, it is made explicitly clear, like, by the narrator that they will not be here like in a year's time.
He will have to go work at, I believe it's a casino, they say.
Yeah, he won't be able to stay living, you know, the life that they have. The trio return to their campsite to find that it has been overrun with a herd of pigs. And it's basically, they can't sleep there now. So they go stay with...
Everything has been desecrated.
Everything has been desecrated. We don't need to go into more detail. Pigs do what pigs do. Fill it in yourself. But they go stay with Choi and his family. You know, they're hanging out. They're kind of having a moment of unity while they're drinking. They're starting to like feel some resolution, you know, even though all of them have this kind of turmoil going on.
They're also drinking a lot. So they're also losing inhibition.
There's a lot of alcohol. They do drink a lot.
Yeah.
But they're starting to, you know, repair the relationship, so to speak, like at least in an amicable way. Yeah. Like they're starting to like have a good time. They start to dance. This is a very like, I would say like what would probably be considered pretty iconic like dance scene.
Oh yeah. No, that is the first thing you think of, that and then just driving across the expanse in the car.
Yeah. And so like all
and the beach.
And the beach.
But that is not the most iconic beach scene in an Alfonso Cuarón film.
That's true. And so, like, they start dancing together, and it eventually results in, like, the three of them, like, hooking up with each other, basically. And that scene ends with Tanuk and Julio, like, kissing. And then they wake up together in bed the next day and absolutely cannot, like, even address.
They can't address it.
That's
a thing that happened, and they do not have the tools to acknowledge it.
Yeah, they're like, all right, and we're going. Luisa reveals at this point that she is not returning with them. She's going to stay here. And they don't really question it. They kind of just go, okay. And they head back home. The end of the movie, we find like...
massive tone shift.
Yeah, massive tone shift. Tanuk and Julio meet up. It's been like a little bit of time. They meet up at a restaurant just to like talk. And it turns out that like Luisa had this entire time.
How much time has it been?
I think they both have started college at this point. They're both at university.
It's been a couple years.
Yeah.
I think it actually goes to present day when the movie, I think it's 2 years.
Mm, that would make sense. And they clearly have lost connection in that time.
Yeah. It makes a point that they have not spoken, which is interesting.
Yeah. And so they're sitting and they're talking together and it's real that Luisa has had terminal cancer and had like found out that same day that she'd gotten the call from her husband. And so you're kind of given this whole different lens on her character what happened, how it happened, why she stayed. And she had died. They were talking about her, how she had passed. And the very end of this movie, they kind of are like, we should hang out sometime or something. And then we are given in no uncertain terms.
You know, it's not going to happen.
They're never going to see each other again, pretty much. And so the tone of this movie gives you like a real sense of like loss, but you're not surprised because you've gone on this journey with them. You've seen how they started and where they ended up here. And so while you're left with like the sense of loss and the sense of like a loss of innocence as well, you're not surprised.
Also, like, their friendship was doomed from the start.
Mm-hmm.
The way this film portrays the culture, we understand that in the adult world, they live in different worlds. You know, in that final conversation, Tanakh calls Julio a hillbilly, and Julio calls Tanakh a yuppie. Like, there is such a intense class divide. But I can't help but be like, they both know something about each other that neither of them can address. Like, that kiss is the reason they can't be friends.
Yeah, and it changes the way that you translate all of their interactions prior to that. The tensions, the camaraderie, the arguments, the jealousy, it all kind of like clicks into place. In addition to all that happening internally with the characters, we also get a really interesting journey through the countryside of Mexico. You know, we spend the first part of the movie kind of in the city, but we then start to see like the world that the boys occupy and they're not really paying attention to throughout the film.
There's some real teeth to it. You have these beautiful landscapes, but then Caron is really speaking about democracy. Like, in the background, there's an election happening. And we see some very undemocratic values in how people are treated on the side of the road, in how the policing is. And he doesn't linger on this, but he paints a very well-fleshed out picture of, again, the class disparity that is at play here and how much privilege they have, but also their apathy to these situations. And, you know, there's no way that they are voting in this election. There's no way that they are engaged in these matters. They're just screwing their way through life and not really considering what's happening to their country and their world.
Yeah, this movie does such a great job of painting, you know, pretty intimate portrayal of two people in this world who are living their lives, but then also the broader world around them that they're kind of deaf to, that they're ignoring. And it makes for a much richer, like, experience.
Even when Choi starts telling his story about how his, you know, he's going to be pushed away from being able to fish. He's going to have to go work at a casino and move to a city. In that moment, you think, oh, maybe this is a wake-up moment for these boys. And you can kind of see the gears turning. And then we see them 2 years later. And it's like, no, you learn nothing.
Business as usual. And also this film has a narrator that cuts through with these really, like, intense truths about various aspects. And the kind of factual way that the narrator discusses the various things that happen to different characters, the world they live in, like Choi's fate, how he will, you know, no longer be there, how the herd of pigs are going to be slaughtered, like, but a day later or something. The narrator is so matter of fact about these various observations, and it just kind of hits home the story so much harder. I think it's also worth mentioning there's a lot of like death motifs over the course of the film and you don't really appreciate what that means for Luisa until at the end when
she's pondering her mortality throughout the entire thing.
Yeah, and you're kind of like, oh my goodness.
What do we think about how things are left with her husband, Yano?
I don't know. Yano is an interesting character because he has like very little screen time, but we know a lot about him.
He also, like, we immediately understand what he's about.
Yeah.
Like, he is this kind of almost caricaturized portrayal of the ruling class in Mexico. He is loud. He is womanizer. He is wealthy and has power.
Yeah. He's also like a wannabe writer who wants to like...
He has the hobbies of an aristocrat.
Yeah, he does have the hobbies of the aristocrat. But he's also like super fragile, like with his sense of identity, his sense of self, his sense of like worth and whatever. And I do kind of love that Luisa's like, no, I'm not giving you that. This is, you've chosen this for yourself.
And she doesn't return to him.
Mm-hmm.
You always think, oh, that they're going to fix it. No, we have no indication that she ever spoke to him again.
Yeah, like it's pretty much clear that she like passes on that beach and never sees him again. And again, one thing I think very interesting, because you kind of know that something else is kind of going on with her if you're like paying attention, because the doctor's office visit. But the doctor's office visit is so like subtle, like not really paid attention to by the narrative.
It's insignificant.
That you don't really, because then it's immediately dwarfed by this reveal that she's being cheated on by her husband. And so you translate all of her actions subsequently as her reacting to him.
Take revenge.
Yeah. Cheating on her. When in reality, she's trying to come to grips with her own mortality over this, you know, course of this movie. And it's really just him cheating on her. That's like the thing that makes her go, okay, all right, well.
Bye.
And it gives her this perspective of an understanding and like, her eyes are opened in a way that the other characters are not, because she is facing like her end, her death, basically. And Tinoc and Julio are just, their lives are just beginning, so to speak. They're living in the moment. They're seeing only their youth and health.
Where do you think that Julio and Tinoc would be today? You know, figure it's been like 25 years.
I mean, I would assume that Tinoc is now like some diplomat working some aristocratic life.
Yeah.
And Julio is, I think he was in college, so it's possible he's taken on a career that was maybe a little bit higher than what he grew up in, but probably not. Like they're probably,
class mobility is not great.
Yeah. So he's probably, you know, much the same. And I would assume they haven't spoken to each other and
probably haven't acknowledged.
Yeah.
Their sexuality.
I would assume they're probably married with kids, or at least, you know, have kids. I don't know if they'd be married, but, you know, fundamentally apart would be how I would describe them now.
Yeah. I love a lot of people put down coming of age movies as being so simple and focused on the idea of youth and, you know, that moment. But I love how movies like this are able to use that as a vessel to show a lot about the world, show things about aging, show things about death, show things about politics. Because our characters are learning about their world, you know, whether they act and what they learn or not is a whole other matter. Because our characters are this sponge sucking up information and experience in the world around them, we're able to experience that through them. And it's a really interesting way to portray a culture or world that you do not know with a lot of complexity.
Yeah, absolutely. I think like coming of age movies have so many organic ways to put commentary, put exploration on things that might feel out of place in other stories, because it's a crossroads for a character. It's a change for the character. It's a character coming into their own. But there's so much opportunity there. And this movie takes full advantage of that.
And like Karan, he's always said that he's not, you know, making a political statement with his films. The year after this came out, he said, the film is a mantra of the old guard. If you don't have a nakedly Marxist ideology, then you're a reactionary. If you have a strong story and production values, then you're a Hollywood wannabe. If you enjoy any success abroad, you're a sellout. Thankfully, we have a new generation that's tossing off this old prejudice about what films can be. You realize that you can't be 100% Mexican and still be a universal experience. And I think that's very real. He's not trying to cater to his audience.
Mm-hmm.
He just presents truth in how he has lived his own experience as someone born in Mexico City, someone who's lived in poverty, as someone who understands these systems. He's not making a CTA, a call to action. He's just painting a picture of life And that's, it leaves you with a lot to think about, and it leaves you with something that you might draw your own call to action from.
Yeah, I think like just painting life is a really great description for his, like, this movie and Roma, and like,
this really does feel like an intense pairing to Roma.
Yes.
There's so much in common. I know they're technically different parts of the country. They're technically, they're a different time period. They're drastically different circumstances. But these dovetail together so beautifully. And I think that's really something that Roma feels like an answer to the unfinished questions of this film about life.
Yeah. Children of Men.
So next we have 2006's Children of Men. As far as availability, this was one of the first titles released on the failed format HD-DVD in early 2007. That was how I purchased it the first time. This was very early in the life of both Blu-ray and HD-DVD, and it has aged quite poorly. It's not a great visual presentation, but it was eventually just ported over to the Blu-ray. It's the same encode, same special features, same everything. And that has not aged well. It's not a great looking way to experience this film. It's very dated, and it's got a lot of compression artifacts and a lot of noise reduction. It's just an utterly subpar experience. So try to avoid that. But there is hope, because there is a gorgeous UK release from a couple years ago from Arrow Academy that has a very nice modern code, much better grain detail. It's just a gorgeous looking film. It is, however, region B locked, so you will need a region free player to play it. So Children of Men premiered at Venice in 2006, and then had like a very limited theatrical run during awards season. It made a bunch of critics' best of lists. It had a lot of buzz, but it didn't really get out of the like film circuit. The following spring, it was nominated by the Academy for Best Adapted Screenplay, Best Cinematography, and Best Editing. And then at the BAFTAs, it won Best Cinematography and Best Production Design.
It stars Clive Owen as Theo, Claire Hope Ashaty as Key, Julianne Moore as Julian Taylor, and Michael Caine as Jasper Palmer.
Well, this is a depressing film.
Oh, so depressing.
It's so 2006 in so many ways, but it also is so relevant today. It's a dystopian work set in Britain. You have a world in which it takes place in 2027, where there has been 18 years of total lack of fertility across the world. Britain has fallen into a state of fascism. There is intense state security, and there is a lack of democracy, and uprising movements are being squashed. You have, again, very clear class divides as the ramifications of this lack of pregnancy has affected the most poor and vulnerable first. You have really, really haunting anti-immigration policies. You have a world in which Britain has left the European Union. And that decision to leave the European Union was rooted in racism and classism.
Don't touch it, Kyle.
But it's there. It's right there.
Oh my gosh.
You have just this world of the very idea of humanity is in question, with the idea of an aging population with no youth, with no new children. What does mortality mean? What does new life mean? What is the human condition? There's also a pretty intense feminist lens in how we can read that, because a lot of it does revolve around like, what is the role of women? How do they affect our culture? How does the idea of maternity affect our culture?
Mm-hmm.
This film is just striking. It's not an easy watch. I've seen it probably 3 times, but it just sticks with you.
Yeah, it is. It's like a what I would say, like, truly dystopian. Like, it is.
Yeah.
So, I don't know, but it's like, it's an action movie, right? But the action feels so real, and there's so much violence, and it It feels like you're like I very everything few times has everything has stakes, and very few times have I seen a movie where I'm like, wow, I feel like I'm like actually here. That movie, like, I felt like I was in there experiencing things with the characters, and none of it is, like, stylized. It's all, like, brutal.
The end of the film has some very long action sequences, mm-hmm. and it feels like such a critique of the empty action without any consequence that happens in a lot of traditional action movies. This is the era of these big post 9/11 action movies that are dealing with very similar ideas about dystopia, but don't have the actual backbone of character and consequence to feel like this. Every time something quote unquote cool happens with action, you feel horrified and stressed.
Yeah, like the cost is never given any kind of lightness. Like, you are constantly aware of the cost of what is happening at every turn.
You're also aware that this is a society that does not value human life, mm-hmm. that does not value people.
Yeah. And a lot of the deaths you are so close to when they happen, it's not like a cool, like, shooting someone from, like, 50 feet away.
No, it's sudden and brutal.
It's sudden, it's brutal, it's up in your face. You can't forget about it and you can't shake it, like, in the next scene. You're carrying it with you for the rest of the film.
So, yeah, we start off showing this dystopia. The UK is one of the few nations that still has an actual government that's functioning at the expense of that, like, as we said, police state and total seizing of power. Immigrants are arrested and either put into camps or executed. Our protagonist is Theo, who has a background in activism, but has kind of submitted to the society and become a bureaucrat. He's kidnapped by a radical group called the Fishes. There's a lot of IRA vibes with this group. Mm-hmm. They're a immigrant rights group that is functioning in the UK with a history of violent bombings. And they're led by Theo's estranged ex-wife, Julian. They actually had separated after their son, who was one of the last born before the crisis of birth, died from a pandemic. Wow. Died from a pandemic at a young age.
Oh my gosh. That just clicked in for me. This movie came out again in 2006.
Yep. You know, it's a 2008 flu pandemic, which, I mean, technically, that was very much a thing that came about. Julian makes contact with Theo and is trying to bribe him to obtain transit papers for a young woman named Key, who desperately needs to get out of the country for reasons that she doesn't really specify, but it's clear that the need is intense. So Theo works with his cousin, who is a government officer and has some connections and is able to obtain the papers. And it has to be her escort because of the way the papers are drawn up. So he winds up in pretty deep with the Fishes. You know, a man named Luke, who is apparently the leader of this sect of the Fishes, starts driving them towards Canterbury to presumably board a boat. You know, they say they're driving towards Canterbury to board a boat. But they get ambushed by an armed gang that suddenly comes out of the woods as they're driving through, you know, this rural part of England. And they, in the conflict, they're trying to get away from this gang. One of them shoots Julian and she is gone. As they're leaving, police are coming towards this swarm and they try to stop the car without really any hesitation. Luke kills the officers, so they hide the bodies. They hide Julian's body and abandon her, and they head to the Fishes' local safe house. If you weren't already clued in that the radical extremist group was not great people, this is where you really start to get a sense of their ferociousness. Sure, they have the right cause, but the wrong methods is a pretty clear message in this film. Key reveals to Theo that she is pregnant, and that is the moment that everything changes in this movie. She is the only known pregnant person in 18 years. Julian's plan had been to take her to a ship that would take them to what's called the Human Project, which is supposedly a independent research group operating in the Azores where there is no more government, doing independent research on what has happened to humanity, dedicated to, you know, curing the problem of infertility. No one is entirely sure that this exists. There's legends. I think about comparisons to, like, you know, in recent times, the video game The Last of Us, where you don't quite know it. The communication is so sparse in the far region of the world because governments have fallen.
Mm-hmm.
With Julian dead, she had been the leader of the entire Fishes operation. And Luke, who was the leader of this sect near Canterbury, uses the power vacuum to take power over the entire group and rapidly starts to shift how things are going to be done to suit his way. Theo overhears him discussing with his gang what's going to happen next. And he learns that this was actually an inside job, that the mob that attacked them were from this sect of the Fishes, and that he basically murdered Julian to seize power. And then he learns that they intend to take Key and use her baby as a political tool and kill everyone else. So that's a warning sign that you shouldn't stick around. So he wakes up Key and Miriam, who has been traveling with them as this caretaker to help with Key's health. She has a background in medicine. We know we kind of get that vibe from how she treats Key. We'll learn more about that later. And they escape to Theo's reclusive hippie friend, Jasper, who is brilliantly played by Michael Caine. He is a political cartoonist who's now a dedicated caregiver for his wife, who has a traumatic brain injury due to being tortured by the British state for her political activism. They regroup at Jasper's hideout, and Jasper is a bit of a security nut, so they feel fairly safe. The ship that they were supposed to rendezvous with is still scheduled to come in a few days, so they need to move. Jasper is in the business of cannabis, and one of his regular customers is an immigration officer. So they work out a deal with this immigration officer to smuggle them into Bexhill, which is the camp next to where the ship is arriving, as refugees. And then they can escape from the camp to meet the ship. That's wild, but that is their best plan, so they have to go with it.
It's worth emphasizing at this point that they are, like, very much fugitives, both from the Fishes and from the British government.
Oh, there is now, like, an announcement on the TV that they're wanted.
Like, there is essentially nowhere that is safe. Like, this is, and it should show, like they're this desperate that this is their best option to do the most bananas insane thing.
And we know that there's, like, the cities have, like, cameras that are able to identify people and things. So, like, they really need to act quickly and act quietly.
The surveillance and the kind of, like, it's, like, kind of subtle, but also not subtle. The way that you feel like everything is being surveyed without you knowing in this movie.
Which is my general thought every time I'm in London. But, and this is about the time that that kind of security was going into place.
Mm-hmm.
Obviously, the UK as of right now has much more reasonable privacy laws than in this dystopian world, but you can see kind of these trickles of things that were current discussions about privacy and state surveillance at the era. They have this kind of, like, last hurrah of a night of just fellowship at Jasper's house. They get to truly, like, get to know each other and have a real moment of, like, almost normality. And then the next day, alarms go off that the Fishes have surrounded the house and are, you know, preparing to enter. So they have to flee very quickly. Jasper stays behind. It's important to note that the UK has sent everyone suicide pills to use for a clean death if they wish to take of that, given the state of humanity. Jasper feeds the pill to his wife and is clearly preparing to, like, close out that chapter. But the Fishes are there, and while the rest of them all escape, Jasper goes and confronts them to Stahl and is murdered in cold blood by Luke. So that is the stakes. That kind of like neatly buttons up where things are. So they have to go make the rendezvous with the immigration officer, and they are boarded onto a bus being sent to this internment camp. On the bus, he begins to go into contractions, and Miriam makes a split-second decision to distract the guards by feigning religious insanity and is dragged away, never to be seen again. This is the first real look at just how rough this life is inside these camps. They then are brought into the camps, where they make a rendezvous with a Romani woman, Mariska, who gives them a room for shelter, and he gives birth to a baby. It's a girl. Bad timing, though, because that's when the refugees start to stage a rebellion, and the military comes in to wipe them out, and then the fishes join the camp to help fight on behalf of the refugees. And suddenly you're in a three-way war right around this place where Key has just given birth, and that they're trying to sneak out to the ship. And oh yeah, they all have a giant bounty on their heads.
So yeah, they have this three-way conflict is happening. Sid basically goes to pick them up and try and get them out, because he does not really yet know what's at stake here. And he finds out about the baby. Yep. Things immediately go south because he decides he's going to turn them in. And so there's this terrifying sequence where they flee along with Mariska, who is also, as one can imagine, absolutely unbelievably shocked about this baby being born. Because again, first baby in like 20
and
years.
And joyful. We see super joy.
Like, yeah, the joy. This was so impactful. The joy of this woman who doesn't know Key.
Yeah.
Seeing this baby.
I mean, just the circumstances of her life. Like, if you're in an internment camp, your odds of, you know, your future is not looking so great. And she's able to experience this joy, not for herself, but for humanity.
Yeah. The absolute joy of her, like, seeing the baby for the first time is just, it's so poignant. But yep. The three of them flee Sid. They manage to, like, lock him in behind a door after, like, they've shot at him / fought with him a little bit. They join the streets where everything is in absolute chaos. Yeah. And this is kind of where things go.
There are tanks rolling through the streets. Things are hitting the wall.
Soldiers
there is
are
heavy fire.
Gunning down people in the street without any kind of hesitation or deliberation. It's brutal. They're shooting buildings. They're bombing, destroying. Like, it's insane.
You can say the Falklands, you can say Belfast. It looks very similar to examples of military entering an insurgency.
Yeah.
Also, it's 2006, the invasion of Fallujah, like the Iraq War. Like, it hits all those notes.
It hits these notes. This idea of again, when warring like groups meet, how it's like the normal everyday innocents who are absolutely crushed underfoot.
Like, yep.
And the film does not shy away from that. It is like brutal, this portion of the movie.
Unflinching. It's very hard to watch.
During this, the three of them run into the fishes. They grab Key and the baby. Mariska, I think, hides. She is not caught, I believe, at this part. And Theo is going to die. Like,
yep.
And for a second, you're like, this is it. This is where the movie ends. And the degree and the gravity of everything that's happened up until this moment leaves you with this moment where you're like, this could happen. He could die right here and this movie could end. There's no plot armor for any of these characters.
In a lot of action movies, it's fairly cliche to have, oh, the fate of humanity rests on our heroes. Mm-hmm. I can't think of another film where it's more palpable what that concept means of our heroes surviving is the fate of humanity.
Yeah. Oh, anyway, the tension. Theo is saved by, ironically, like the soldiers coming through, trying to like who are gunning down insurgents and refugees. Theo is able to escape in that chaos and go to look for Key, who's been taken into one of these buildings that is surrounded by soldiers and getting shelled. And again, unflinching destruction as you follow Theo up the stairs in this building to find Key.
Yeah, the building is, it's just utterly falling apart.
And yeah, and he passes all these people who have tried to hide there to be safe. And you know that they're not going to leave this building alive, likely, because the soldiers aren't stopping until everybody is completely dead. These soldiers aren't stopping until every single refugee is gone. So Theo finds Luke and Key. Luke is splitting time between like trying to like shoot out the window at the soldiers slash keep an eye on Key. He even turns a gun on them. Does Luke get killed?
Yep. A shell hits him.
Yeah. A shell hits Luke, which allows for Theo and Key and the baby to exit. There's this really beautiful moment where the baby's cries kind of silence all the destruction and the death and hopelessness that is around, that is happening, where they walk through the building and the refugees are like seeing this baby.
It's not just the refugees. The soldiers have entered the space.
Yeah. The soldiers who were in the space. The soldiers
are there.
Yeah.
The soldiers are there and everyone stops fighting because of the awe of a baby.
Yeah. Everybody is just overcome with this. And it's an absolutely poignant scene as they walk out. They even walk out into the ranks of soldiers who have, but seconds ago, have been shelling this building, killing without any kind of mercy. And everybody stops with wonder over this child.
Yep.
And then as soon as they pass through, they go back to fighting.
Yes.
Yeah. It's such a contrast. Key and Theo hurry to the water. They meet Mariska again. Mariska has a boat for them. She is not coming with them. And so the two of them set out alone into the sea. They'd missed their rendezvous point. And Key is giving in to like despair. She's like, they're not going to come back. And Theo's like, they will come back for this. They will come back for the child. So they get to the rendezvous point. We then realize that Theo's actually been hit with an injury at some point during all of this. And the adrenaline is kind of been what has kept him going this whole time.
Yeah.
And so as he dies, we see in the distance a boat coming for Key, and we get this sense that she is going to you know, be safe, but we don't know. We're left with total uncertainty about the future of everything.
As this is happening, there's fighter jets flying overhead, dropping bombs on what's left of the camp.
Mm-hmm.
So just total annihilation of humanity. And Theo is dying, and he's instructing Key in how to care for a baby in his dying breaths. And she promises him that she will name this baby girl Dylan after Theo's son. And then, like, it fades to black.
And we don't know what happens next.
We just hear children playing. That's a movie.
emotions. It's such a... it evokes these emotions without ever feeling like cheap or like it's grabbing for something. Like, the weight of everything is known to you throughout the entire story.
And it all feels earned. It all feels consistent, and I think the most haunting thing is how real it feels.
Yeah.
It feels so possible.
Yes.
And quite frankly, given the last X number of years in our world, it feels much more possible than it did when I first saw it.
Yeah, the fact that it was made in 2006 and it resonates so hard in 2024 is insane to me. And makes the movie that much more haunting to watch.
It also really threads this needle between like futility and hope.
Mm-hmm.
I do consider it a hopeful movie. It's just a very hard watch.
Yeah, it's a hopeful movie, but it's not blind or naive to the worst qualities of the human race at the same time.
It's hopeful despite that.
Yeah. One thing that really gets me is the characters in this film, because there's not really a lot of time to really do a lot of like character backstory, etc. You know, where it's fairly fast paced and the plot of trying to get to this rendezvous point is the all important thing here. But the way the characters' personalities and backstory and things are shown through in the dialogue, in the scenes. Like the idea that Key, who's grown up in a world where there are no babies, there are no children, Theo instructing her on how to take care of a baby.
Because, yeah.
Because she's never...
No one knows.
No one knows.
And you can't count on... Yeah. I mean, assuming that, like, a lot of people have died, you don't know who was alive and of an age where they would have had experience caring with a baby, when people who are in their 30s and 40s, you know,
yeah,
might not.
And Key is so young. She doesn't really even realize, like, at first, like, she doesn't know what pregnancy or how anything works, because she thought that it would just be impossible. So she's this very young girl thrust into this insane position. And yeah, that just scene where Theo is yeah, explaining how to care for a baby, it just really hits you.
Quran is not subtle in his references to historical events. Mm-hmm. In the moment where we first see the British state, you know, stripping and assaulting refugees and, you know, kind of making it clear that their fate is a concentration camp where they will eventually die, you have the theme, you have Arbeit macht frei by the Libertines playing, which is, of course, drawn from Work Sets You Free, which was famously the saying that hangs over the entrance to Auschwitz. We have all this very modern imagery of, you know, technology in a police state and footage of the kind of insurgency conflict that has dominated modern eras. There's a lot of notes of the IRA. There's a lot of notes of the Iraq War. It's not unwilling to be like, hey, fascism is at the root of this. This is where what gets us here. You know, refugees are hunted without... They don't need a reason to be killed in this world. And that is very haunting. I just find it so interesting that he went straight from making Prisoner of Azkaban to this.
Ugh. The contrast.
The other big aspect is, of course, religion.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
The title pulls itself from a verse in the Psalms. Thou turnest man to destruction and sayest return, ye children of men. And the author of the book has called the story a Christian fable. Quran has implied that it's a nativity allegory. The movie came out at Christmas. It's a really interesting lens of the mythology of Christianity painted against our current political tales. You can kind of draw a lot of comparisons to the world in which in the Christian story, you have refugees with a purpose, with a pregnancy, trying to keep a baby safe. That I think that's a very interesting lens. The fishes, the name fishes as the group fighting. There's a lot of religious symbolism here. It's never clearly in the center, but it is consistently lingering, and it kind of fleshes out the ideas about what this film says about humanity. You know, there's a lot of little references there.
Yeah, I definitely remember, like, especially when just doing the summary, talking about the plot, comparisons you can draw to Mary and Christ with the baby and Key.
She even jokes that she's a virgin when she's asked to the
powers,
like, and they're in a barn.
And the idea of like a miraculous conception, again, out of Christian mythology, is like, just, you know, the lines are really like clear to draw there if you're paying attention to it. Yep. But the absolute just emotional weight of the turbulent times this baby is born into and what this baby means for humanity. And then again, drawing back to what's talked about in Christianity, this idea of this baby being born in these turbulent times, who again is very important to the fate of humanity. It's like, it's so intimate and emotional while also like just being brutally like desolate at the same time. It's like a hopeful movie, but you have to work for it.
Yeah. I find it interesting how Quran is so focused on the idea of humanity, but he also never loses scope of the characters and who their story is. Now, he doesn't bog it down with a ton of backstory. We're kind of just thrown into these people and their lives, and we learn through hints of through the interaction. It's all very naturalistic. But they are a vessel for us to understand this world without explaining too much. You really have to pay attention to this movie to get a good grasp of all of the subtlety that is going on here and what the stakes are, but it rewards you so well when you pay attention to that.
It does. Again, like a movie that rewards you for actually like looking and paying attention to it. And the way that the story is kept so grounded with these characters, we go from very intimate, fun, sweet moments between these characters just living, being people, to these brutal mm-hmm. situations that they're thrown into, like all in the same shot. It's so, yes, the tension keeps you on the edge of your seat and things like that. But the juxtaposition of these tender, sweet, very grounded human moments and then these insane like acts of violence and danger and horror that also take place. It's so powerful.
Well, also, you mentioned all in the same shot, and a lot of these sequences happen all in one continuous take. Mm-hmm. There is up to a 6-minute take in this movie. That is just entirely uninterrupted. And Caron has flirted with these ideas before. We talked about during Et tu Maman Timbien, the scene of them just kind of drinking and having revelry that one night. It's all one take, and you have a lot of things happening, a lot of character exposition happening. In Prisoner of Azkaban, you have the scene where Harry Potter learns that Sirius Black supposedly was the reason his parents died. That is this kind of brilliant long shot of Harry watching, spying from under an invisibility cloak, and it's all uninterrupted for a number of minutes. Caron likes these long shots. Roma, we're going to talk about, has Roma is basically this done continuously. But what's interesting in Children of Men is he's able to hit these character beats and use subtext to convey a whole lot of information about who these characters are in shots that are often taking place in massive battles. The ambush, the battle at the end. We're learning a lot of information as all of these things are happening. These are very complicated shots from an effects perspective. There's hundreds of people involved. It's kind of insane. And then, like, one of the other significant long shots of the movie is the birth. And he chooses to have this very stripped down, you know, just a room in a very subpar house in a concentration camp. And we just kind of watch the birth happen in an intensely unflinching way. We don't get a lot of character information here. It just happens. We'll be talking about the French New Wave next week again. That influence is pretty clear there. You want to talk about music?
Not going to lie. The music didn't really hit for me.
Really?
No, I was too wrapped up in, I was too wrapped up in the stuff that was happening that I wasn't even paying attention to the score, which is unusual for me because usually the score is the first thing I notice about a movie.
Yeah. It used a lot of needle drops, but also like it synthesizes a bunch of like human sounds of like traffic and things mm-hmm. to a musical beat. It's kind of interesting. So yeah, that's Children of Men, a film that is really interesting to revisit given the all the various crises we've experienced as a world over the last 8 years. It feels very prescient. But our next film is Roma, which came out in 2018. This is a film that Caron made for Netflix. It was one of Netflix's earliest large-scale film productions. It's available on Netflix worldwide, but in the US we do actually have a physical media release. It is not 4K, but Criterion has released it in the US and the UK. You have to weigh the merits of the higher bitrate, which is a significantly sharper picture on the Blu-ray versus the 4K Netflix stream, which has HDR, and this film's black and white makes a really dramatic use of HDR. I personally side with the Blu-ray. I think the Blu-ray is a really wonderful release, and I love the idea of supporting buying Netflix movies on physical media. There's also a lot of really wonderful special features. The film premiered at Venice in 2018, where it won the Golden Lion, and was nominated for 10 Academy Awards, which was the first time a film produced by a streaming service was nominated for Best Picture. It tied Crouching Tiger, Hidden Dragon for the most Oscar nominations ever received by a film not in English. I believe that might have been broken by Parasite a few years later, though. And it wound up taking Best Director, Best Cinematography, and Best Foreign Language Film. And of course, this is my first year voting for The Spirits. We did nominate for Best International Film, which it then won.
This movie follows the story of this upper class family and their trials and tribulations as a household, not just the family members, but also the maids who also work in the house. Cleo is our main character, played by Yalitza Aparicio. And the story follows her as she experiences life with this family, but also goes through her own journey. Marina de Tavira plays Sophia, who is the matriarch of the family or the mother of the family. Not really matriarch. There's a grandmother in this family as well. It stars Fernando Grediega as Antonio, Sophia's absent husband. So not really stars. He's kind of not there.
His absence is continually felt, though. But he is,
yes.
He is a doctor, and that fulfills his role of providing their status economically.
Absolutely. And Jorge Antonio Guerrero stars as Furman, who is Cleo's lover.
How do we even talk about this movie? There is so much going on here. There is so much history. There is so much soul. This is another movie about like family and life and class and life in turbulence. There is some really shocking upheaval happening during this film's events. It's also like it takes a very cynical approach to like romance and life.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
It's very detached. It also, much like Children of Men, deals with the idea of fertility in some very unflinching ways.
Yeah, I think you best described this movie as like ideas when we were talking about it earlier.
It's vignettes. It's glimpses into a life or into multiple lives.
Glimpses into multiple lives. And again, just showing real life in a way that's so intimate, but also cinematic.
So like the very first shot we see in the movie is this gorgeous wide shot of Cleo mopping away dog feces in the driveway of their Mexico City home. And that kind of sets an allegory up of the insidious corruption of the upper class in this culture. It's 1970. We see Antonio, who is a doctor, is kind of absent from his family's life. He's often leaving for business conferences. He drives this giant Ford Galaxy, which is like the image of excess and does not fit in Mexico City at all. Like, he is struggling to make it into his parking space. It is kind of an allegory for how audacious he can be. He lives with his four children, his wife, and his wife's mother. They also have staff. His wife is convinced that his travel is an affair, and that's something that comes up very early in the film. He keeps traveling up to Canada for medical presentations, and it's a clear implication of an affair. But then pretty quickly, we pivot our perspective to Cleo, who has this domestic life of her needs are met. She has a boyfriend. She seems fairly happy in her circumstance. Her boyfriend seems supportive, but she's pregnant. This was not a planned pregnancy. Her life is not really in a position where pregnancy is a feasible option. Her boyfriend, upon learning this, abandons her at the movies and goes away to go back to this like martial arts paramilitary group that he's part of. She tells her boss, Sophia, the mother, who does provide the kind of emotional support that her boyfriend should have provided, and immediately takes her to the local hospital and to make sure she's getting everything she needs. And kind of like is very clear that like you will be part of this family. We will take care of you appropriately. It kind of says everything that should be said at this time to comfort Cleo.
And at this point in the story, like Sophia's husband has basically left. He's gone. She knows he's gone. She's been telling the kids that he's coming back soon. But at this point in the movie, you know that both Sophia and Cleo have been like abandoned by like the men in their lives.
Yeah. Sophia, because of her husband's absence, basically decides to take Cleo and her children for New Year's to a family friend's hacienda in the country. And we get a very Quran-esque glimpse into the politics of this rural area with a bunch of discussion of the recent land tension built around class. But we then see this like great excess of celebration and kind of like drunken frivolity happening among these wealthy people. And Cleo is very much an outsider here. You know, she doesn't really fit with the rest of the, because she's not working. She's on vacation with them, but she's not with them. A large forest fire breaks out, likely as a result of the partying, and the group kind of bands together to help extinguish it, which I think is a kind of poignant comparison to the rest of the movie. An interesting vignette of the carefree life that they have and that
the consequences sometimes like rear up on you. Mm-hmm. But they return to the city. Cleo sees her boss, Antonio, the patriarch of the family, in Mexico City when he's supposed to be in Canada, with a young woman flirting on the street. And that is her confirmation of what has happened. And she doesn't tell this to Sophia, but she knows, and we know. She goes to try to look for her estranged boyfriend, Fermin. And she goes out to a rural area at the edge of the city where she finds the paramilitary group that he's training with. This group is actually led by Professor Zovek, who was a real escape artist, kind of an allegory of like a Houdini figure, who was a stunt artist in Mexico at this era. So that's kind of like this intensely hyper-masculine paramilitary group Fermin is a part of. And when she tries to confront him to say, I need you to help me with this baby, he refuses. The baby is his. He calls her a whore and then threatens to beat her and their child if she brings this up again. So that just kind of closes that door. Yeah, we see what the rhetoric that he has immersed himself in has turned him into. So Cleo returns to the city and things are not going well. Things are kind of falling apart. Sophia is trying to keep a straight face for her children about their life, but everything is falling apart. The finances are not what they used to be, obviously. Her husband has not sent money. The children are starting to understand what's going on, and they're understanding through eavesdropping and hints rather than an actual discussion, which creates a fair amount of tension. Teresa, the grandmother, takes Cleo shopping for baby items for a crib, and it is June of 71. So while they are in downtown Mexico City, you see the hawk strike. It begins, which was a massacre of student protesters that happened in Mexico City by paramilitary groups in the Mexican Dirty War. There is this intense parallel. So there's this intense contrast between shopping for a crib for a coming baby, and in the streets right outside, you have a violent mob where many, many, many people are murdered. And it all comes to a head when a group of the paramilitary group, the Hawks, chase a student into the store. And one of the Hawks is Fermin, who murders the student and then points his gun at Cleo and Teresa, clearly identifying them before exiting. So that's kind of our first like real dose of how turbulent things actually are, despite this kind of like posh upper class vibe. The stress of having a gun pointed at her face and having all this violence around her causes Cleo to go into premature labor and her water breaks. And they are struggling to get to the hospital in traffic because of the violence. So they're sitting in traffic as she's in agony in labor quite a bit prematurely. When they finally arrive, Antonio is the attending doctor. He, you know, tries to provide reassurance on the surface and hands her over to the OBGYN, but then immediately like leaves. And Theo's baby is delivered stillborn.
So after this very traumatic event of both the violence in the streets and then also like her baby being born stillborn, Cleo is kind of in this depression, like you feel this weight. And Sophia decides that the whole family is going to go on holiday all together. Cleo's going to come too, and she's going to be like part of it. This is like the second time Cleo's traveled, not as like working, but just as part of the family. Mm-hmm. But it ends differently in this time, because they go to this beach and they're all together, and Cleo doesn't swim. Again, the juxtaposition of someone in Cleo's position, like learning to swim would be like a survival skill thing, whereas the kids are just playing in the waves because it's play for them.
Well, even in the U.S., I mean, compare black children versus white children for swimming education. The disparity is massive. This is 100% both a class and a race thing.
Absolutely. Yeah. It's worth mentioning here. So Cleo is of indigenous descent, and Sophia and her family are clearly of European descent.
Yep.
So that like race and class is very clearly presented to you, the viewer. One of the smaller kids wants to go back to the car for something, and Sophia takes the kid with her and asks Cleo to keep an eye on the children. Cleo tries to make a very clear boundary of like, okay, but like, you know, the kids need to stay within on the beach because I can't swim. I can't save them. Sophia tells the kids to, you know, do as she says. But what do kids do? Often not listen. And one of the children is like, goes out into the water and Cleo loses sight of him.
We've been told there are riptides in this area and he is fully underwater.
Mm-hmm. And so then Cleo, with like no hesitation, goes into the water after him. She manages to rescue him and the other kid. There were two of them were in the water. And they crawl back to the beach. And it's just this very intimate, emotional moment where Cleo kind of breaks down.
They are at this point a family unit.
Yeah.
Those barriers have been torn down. They are a new family with Cleo included. And they're able to share in her pain.
Exactly. Like she breaks down and she says, like, I didn't want this baby, all this. And the sheer like love and care that they show back to her in this moment breaks the barriers that have been like up until this moment really emphasized in this movie.
Yeah.
And you get this beautiful shot of them all like Sophia and all the kids and Cleo just clinging to each other on this beach, having this incredibly like raw emotional moment.
That is the moment of the film. And the kind of wrapping things up, we see the family return to their home and kind of start to build a new life. And the house has been, you know, the structure has changed in the house. They are a more integrated unit. But Cleo kind of returns to just her domestic life.
Mm-hmm. I think it's so fascinating, the dynamics in this movie, because the relationship that Cleo has with these children, even though they're not her kids, is...
Oh, she is. She knows those kids better than the mother.
Yeah, and the kids love her back. It's not, you know, her caring on a one-sided basis.
But there is still that divide that she is not one of them.
Yes, very clearly emphasized throughout the movie. And the complexities of her relationship with Sophia are also very interesting to me because Sophia's her employer.
But also her friend, but that that threat is always there because there is a power imbalance in their friendship.
Yeah. And Sophia's obviously having a very turbulent time with her husband leaving her and the finances and everything.
Yeah.
And there's these really like, I love how realistic, how real to real people these characters are because Sophia has these moments where she lashes out at Cleo because of other issues in her life and snaps at her or threatens her or something. And
she's projecting. Yeah.
She's just projecting, you know, then it comes back to these scenes where she is showing care for Cleo, taking her to the hospital, things like that. Like the way that everybody in this movie acts like has a normal human reaction to the difficulties in their lives just makes it so much more like rich of an experience to watch this family come together.
And Sophia and Cleo also both are experiencing the men in their lives failing them, either through not being loyal, not being there, not being present, not, you know, they're both kind of on a parallel path, but with very different circumstances because Sophia is able to kind of maintain this presentation of normality. Cleo has no safety net, and that is a difference there. Men in general are portrayed as lacking in ability to and lacking commitment in kind of self-serving. I read an essay linking the family dog to the symbolic male identity of excitable, won't stop talking, and shits everywhere. And that's, I think that's a little bit of a stretch, but also... maybe that is intended. I don't know. There's definitely something going on with the turds. That's all I'm saying. There's a lot of imagery of turds piling up in their kind of front garden and being washed away.
That is true. That is a repetitive imagery. Yeah, the way this movie shows a perspective of what it is to be like a woman in a family, you are reminded that, you know, they rely on these men for livelihood, for care, for love. And the way that you get the female perspective of being abandoned and failed by men is really powerful.
You also have obviously fairly intense ideas about like the suppression and failure of democracy, which parallels to the other two films. This is like the strongest link between these films, you know. You have soldiers and paramilitary groups basically in bed with each other, taking down student protesters who are trying to argue for a more democratic future. You have spaces of refuge like hospitals and shops and whatever being turned into war zones. You also have like the idea of at Furman's paramilitary group, they talk about there is a gringo from America, and it's basically heavily implied that he is a CIA plant. So like, it's kind of getting to do these violent groups operate independently, or are they just pawns in a larger conflict? And that is something we see time and time again. Also in the forest fire incident while they're at the hacienda, it's like, was that fire caused by their, you know, kind of drunken indifference, or was that caused by the local indigenous people trying to argue that they should have access to the land? Mm. And was it planted? I think Rome was my favorite Cuarón film, honestly. It's really hard to discuss because it's so much just images and moments. It feels so fleeting, yet so lasting.
Yeah, like it's a movie that explores a lot of different ideas while following this family that you can really only get a true impression for by watching it.
Yeah, it feels the city as a character. You have so much little detail in this world. So much care is put into accuracy, and you can tell Cuarón grew up in this neighborhood of Mexico City, and you can tell that it's really a love letter to his own childhood. It's not autobiographical, but it is deeply steeped in the world he grew up in. The politics of Mexico are in a time where you are past the worst of the massacres by the PRI, but they are still in power, and that is through corruption, essentially. And we see how infectious that corruption is on culture in many subtle ways. So it's easy to think about how they might be in bed with these paramilitary groups that are causing this very direct violence. But we don't think about how that corruption is affecting the economics of our characters, how that corruption is affecting what films they're able to see, what resources they have, what social services they have access to. You know, Cuarón is able to paint this really complex narrative that is the story, not a message. It is a story, not a message, but still that story compels us to action because of the experiences that we're journeying on.
Yeah, again, with all three of these films, the way these characters are so strongly, you know, impacted by the world that they are in, and how you get a sense for the larger things moving in this world directly impact normal everyday people, but the story is still focused on those normal everyday people that gives it this grounding realness, like that you just couldn't do if you zoomed out to be like, now let's talk about the larger picture here.
No, we infer what's going on politically and economically from how it affects these people's lives. We're able to understand and draw allegory. It's really a powerful piece. One thing that really aids how powerful it is the way it's shot. This is one of the first movies shot on the Alexa 65, which is a digital camera with a 65mm sensor. And Cuarón chose to shoot it in black and white. But he didn't want to shoot it on film. He wanted to shoot it digitally with this incredibly high-resolution digital picture. So it's black and white, but it's an intensely like clean and sharp image. And he is entirely unflinching about using these really long, slow takes where we can just kind of drink in what's happening. Even if it's a simple event like mopping a floor or sitting on a beach having a mental breakdown, the camera does not move quickly at any point. He really indulges in our ability to just sit and watch and drink it in this like grand scope of the picture, which feels really unique. A lot of times movies that are framed like this don't have that kind of grand scale in their cinematography.
I do find it so interesting that this movie was distributed by Netflix.
Yeah. So most people saw it on a small screen or a phone.
Yeah, exactly. And yet it is so like grand and takes its time.
I was able to see this for the first time in a theater. And just that opening shot of the father pulling the car into the parking garage is so is so, there's so many things happening there.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
You got to see this on a big screen.
Maybe one day.
But I think that's it.
I think that does wrap us up for today.
Yeah, some good discussions about some really good films. These are all wonderful. They're all just so human. I would love to talk about Quran some more. At some point, I would love to talk about Little Princess. But next week, we will be discussing Breathless by Jean-Luc Godard, which is one of the seminal works of the French New Wave. We will be following that up with The Graduate by Mike Nichols, which is, you know, one of the early works of the New Hollywood movement and is very responsive to the French New Wave and signified a great shift in how American filmmaking was treated. And then we'll close out with Martin Scorsese's Mean Streets. So we got some really, really interesting stuff to cover, and hope you have a good 2 weeks.
If you enjoyed this episode, please give us a review or a rating on Spotify, Apple Podcasts, or Audible. And we really appreciate you taking time out of your day to listen to us talk about some movies. I'll see you in 2 weeks, Kyle.
See you in 2 weeks. Bye.
Bye.